All right, so there's power and there's microphones here at the table, and we're non-formal, so please come and sit at the table where there's power. This is not a formal meeting, so if you want power or access to the microphone, please feel free to sit at the tables. All right, because our room is challenging to find, we're going to give it a couple more minutes to let people get here. And as I said before, our, you know, non-formal. So if you want power or if you want access to the microphone, please feel free to come up to the table. This is a very open session. So otherwise, we'll start in about 3 or 4 minutes. Okay, we're officially in day one of the ICANN meeting. I don't know if any of you have been here for days and days and days already like I have, but sure doesn't feel like day one. I want to welcome you guys. This is the first session this morning of the How It Works tutorials. We did a complete day yesterday. This is a repeat for those who might have been in the newcomer sessions or at other meetings. I know that there was some CCWG meetings and some other meetings going on yesterday too. So I welcome you all here today. The whole program, we'll look at it from an umbrella, and then I'll drill down to Daniel's session today. But the whole program is pretty interesting, so if you've got some time today, I welcome you guys to stay with us throughout the day. We have, starting out with this overview on the World Wide Web Consortium, which Daniel Dadier, close enough, he's mocking me now, will be running. Followed by, after lunch, we'll do a session on registration protocols. And then, no, I'm sorry, I've got that backwards. Followed by a session on internet networking, routing, and stuff like that with Alain Durand. Following that is the registration protocols, which will be run by David Conrad, our CTO at ICANN. And then lastly, we have a session on the root server operations and the root ops and the root server system advisory committee. So that's a really interesting one as well. So if you guys have time throughout the day, please keep stopping by or commit the day with us. We'd love to have you all here. There's a couple seats left. We're totally non-formal. If you want power, if you want microphone, please come by. If you have a question, if you're not at the table, please raise your hand. I've got this here handheld mic. I'll run it over to you. And with that, I'm going to pass it on to Daniel, and welcome and thank you.
It's okay? Okay. Better on. Okay. Hello. Good morning, everybody. Salam. Bonjour. So my name is Daniel Dardaillet. I work for the W3C. So it's the World Wide Web Consortium, and it's the standard organization for the web. So when you use the web, HTML or styling, HTTP, etc., you use our technology. So we're officially an application of the internet. So that's why you're not hearing a lot about us within the ICANN, usually a community, even though we've been historically attached to ICANN, you know, so I'll mention some of that later on. So I'm going to give an overview of the structure and the, you know, the work of W3C, and then I'll go in some technical activity after that. And, you know, you can ask questions whenever you want, but I'll probably stop midway to ask for, you know, for questions. So W3C is an independent organization. It's headed, you know, the director is the person who invented the web 25 years ago, 27 years ago in 1989-90, Tim Berners-Lee. And we're an organization that is producing standards for the web under the direction of the industry and the community. So we have members that come from mostly the big, you know, an editor of software on the internet. You have Google, Facebook, IBM, but also a lot of academic institutions, government agency. We have also industry that are not on the internet, like the automotive industry, the health industry. Everybody is interested in the web, so we have a lot of participants from different sectors. The staff of W3C is quite small, you would say, for an organization that is doing the standard for the platform such as the web. If you compare to other standard organizations, we're probably an order of magnitude smaller than something like ETSI or ISO or ITU. I mean, we're a small organization. Was created as an application area of the IETF, in fact, about 20 years ago. The focus is, of course, only on the web and both on the standard and guideline that makes the web, but also in helping the implementation of this standard. So we have implementation testing phase. We have validator that runs on the web that people can use to validate their content, things like that. And, of course, since the web as a platform is just one layer of the entire information society, you have IETF and IEEE dealing with lower technology stack like Wi-Fi or TCP/IP. W3C is dealing with HTML, XML, all the application. And top of us, you have application of the web like Facebook or Google that are really also providing a platform for programmers. So we have to liaise and be in contact with all these other organizations so that's a lot of our time as well. So the structure of W3C, much like the IETF, it's an internet organization, so it's not incorporated. We're not we don't have a legal existence. We're a project shared between different parties that are legal entities themselves. So in our case, it's the mostly neutral academic institution that represents a geographical area. So we have MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston, where the consortium was created in 1994, who has about 20 staff. Then in Europe, it's ERSIM, which is a national, French national organization, but representing all the European computer scientists, basically, a research center. We have a center in KO and also one in Beiyang that we created more recently. So these organizations are what collect the finance of W3C, whether it's member fee or it's a grant or anything, and that pays the salary of people like me, staff. So they are not involved so much in the technical coordination of the activity that is done by a process. Like the ICANN bylaws, we have a process that explains how to create a group, how to produce a standard, etc. We have different constituency, of course, within W3C. It's much simpler than with ICANN. We have a technical architecture board, which deals with technical issue mostly related to the web architecture itself, making sure that all the pieces of the web, whether it's HTML, XML, semantic web, mobile web, they fit together under the same architecture. And we have a more organizational advisory board, something that deal with strategic orientation of W3C, whether or not we should change our membership model or have different kind of meetings, etc. So the work we do result in producing a W3C standard that we call recommendation. And those recommendations, they have been worked on within working group, then they have been sent to the public. We have very strong public transparency point. We want all our standards to be available for everybody before they are declared standards so that people can look at what's going on. And we also deal with post recommendation work. That is, we do sometimes we send our specification to ISO for what's called transposition. So you have heard of probably the accessibility standard of W3C for making content on the web accessible to people with disability. Now, that has become an ISO standard as well because we've been asked by our community to transpose that into an ISO standard. I'll come back to that later to explain the reasoning behind that. So that's a map representing the world and the position of the W3C presence. So you have the dot in red are the host, MIT, Europe, Japan, China, and the blue dots are the W3C offices. There are relay points that explain how to participate in W3C, what is W3C doing nowadays. So it's an outreach point with technical, usually, capability as well. So you have one in Morocco. You can see the dot here in Northeast Africa. That's in Rabat at the Mohammedia School of Engineering. And you can talk to the person in charge, Najib Tunsi. We have students from the University of Rabat in the room, so I encourage them to go and see and talk to Najib if they want to learn more. Okay, so a word about W3C Finance. So we're a small organization. We have about 60, 70 staff. We're funded mostly by a member's fee. So depending on the size of the member, if you're Google, you're going to pay about $60,000, $70,000 per year. If you're a small organization, non-for-profit, in Africa, you're going to pay $500. So it's different depending on your geography, on your turnaround. And in the end, everybody has one seat. So if you're a small organization in Morocco, you have one seat like IBM or Google. And the reason for that is that what makes the difference, we're not voting, in fact. It's not a voting mechanism. We're working by consensus. So if we have a working group with participants from the industry and from academia, from everything, everybody has one vote, but we're not voting. So it doesn't mean anything. It means that people that provide technology can more defend the technology and participate in the whole cycle of standardization. And usually their influence is seen at the level of participation in the working groups, not so much at the level of voting for W3C itself. Although we have some election to elect some of our advisory or technical architectural board, and where there is voting involved. So you can see we have some government contract as well on this graphic. So just to describe the graphic, the turnaround of W3C every year is about $10 million, and we get most of it from the members, but also government contract when we do web technology that are more advanced. You can think of the semantic web, or for a while, you know, the accessibility work of W3C was funded by, it still is for some aspect, but by the European Commission, because they see a lot of benefit in having a stable reference for themselves procuring technology to the market. So if you're a government and you want to make website accessible to blind user or any kind of accessibility problem, then you have to make a reference to a standard so that the people that you're buying technology to can apply this standard. And for a while, so there was no standard for accessibility, so they helped W3C come up with a very recognized standard. And that has been also transposed into an international standard nowadays. At some point, we get some help from also donation, like ISOC helped us a few years ago to go through some difficult time. You know, W2C is non-for-profit, so every year we consume all the resource we have, and we count on the year after to do the same thing with flexibility in membership, in grant that we get from government that we know nothing in advance, of course. We are like everybody. We don't have any particular right to get government money, so we run for proposal for grant like everybody else, like any labs, in the world. So the membership of W3C in this pie chart, you see that it's a lot of Occidental, participation, a lot of U.S., but also if you add up the European participation, you get about the same. And then there's worldwide participation, but not to the level that you would expect. So we opened a site and a strong presence in China recently to open more the participation from the Pacific region as well. If you are interested in doing some outreach for W3C, becoming an office in your region, the door is open. You have all the information on the site. So a word on the standardization life cycle. It's pretty classic. You get working drafts that are published on a regular basis that are being worked on by engineer in working groups about that size, you know, you would have about the same room for W3C meeting that we have today for this tutorial, and people around the table would talk about their implementation of some video element, and other would say, well, we have done it differently. We added this parameter to the element. And so it's very technical. There's never like a policy, really, a question or political question. And it's in the interest of participants to have the standard go their own way, the way they implemented something already. So the role of the W3C staff is always to try to find a consensus. So we have chair, we have a support to get, you know, the fact on our side to explain what was the reason for making a decision. So everything is traceable, transparent, and that is, you know, very useful when you get to the final vote. Before you express yourself against or in favor of something, you have all the tracking of all the issue and their resolution. Even when they come from the public, it's not just a member privilege. Any issue that is brought up against a specification has to be resolved. So we have this cycle of different document state, working draft, candidate recommendation where we call for implementation, etc. So one strong aspect of W3C is that we produce royalty-free standard, which is quite unique in the standardization world, in fact. Most of the standardization organization, they produce what's called RAND standard, reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. And the web and the internet are so much, you know, involved with the open source movement, then we cannot afford having anything in form of a royalty to be paid for a standard, because otherwise the open source community is not going to take up the standard technology. So we have this obligation on one side, and we also have our industry that has agreed to the principle that sharing a platform of technology, sharing a patent pool in sense, because they all have patent, you know, all the industry have patent on web technology, but they agree to share this patent pool so that, you know, people bringing more technology to the pool will be sure that there is not going to be any encumbrance on the technology. And if someone doesn't play the game, then basically they are out of the web. That's the way it works in W3C. If you want to standardize the technology, but you have a patent on it, then, you know, it may be that it becomes a standard. But then all the other technology that are today on the web, XML, Stylesheet, you name it, you cannot use it for free anymore. That's the defensive system of the patent pool. It's very powerful. So if you now think about the model of W3C, everything we do, we give it away for free. It's on the web. You can take the standard of HTML and print it and sell it, right? And you cannot also have any royalty on the technology. So why are the members, you know, paying us? Everything we do is free, and we don't sell anything. That's, again, because they understand that the growth of the platform itself is what is going to make them rich. It's not the fact that they own a piece of the technology of the web platform, is that it has to grow, you know. It has potential of billions of users. And, you know, when you have billions of users, even if you have 1% share of this market, you're rich. So, you know, that's the idea. So what is the open web platform? So it's today the web is an operating system, basically. It's something that gives programmer an environment to make application. If you think of Facebook or the Google app for spreadsheet, Google Sheet, whatever it's called, it's an application. It's hard to make the difference between that and a native application. So that's the way the web is moving. It's moving toward making a platform for programmer that is as powerful as the native platform. Plus the advantage that it's a universal platform. If you solve your application problem on the web and it works fine on the web, then it works for everybody on the planet. Anyone that has a browser can use your application. You don't have to install anything. You just click on the link and you have the application. And you have the guarantee that your application is going to evolve smoothly without having to update. You know, I've been using Google application for years. They probably went through, you know, dozens of releases and never saw that. You know, before that, when I had, you know, Microsoft Excel, I would have to update, you know, new version of the application, no matter how, you know, how stable it was for a while. So that's the power of the web, no update, seamless application. And we're, you know, making it sure that you can do the same thing on the web that you can do on a mobile platform. That's the hard thing today, because the mobile platform is creating new device, new capacity at the device level that were not, of course, foreseen on the web initially. If you think of the accelerometer, which is a function of the mobile phone that you can access as a programmer. You can ask your phone, if you're writing an application for a mobile, in which direction is the phone. You cannot do that in HTML4, right? Because there was no accelerometer on any browser platform. So we have to add all this device thing. So the open web platform, as I mentioned, is mostly like a system with various library, various foundation that provide you with graphics, with multimedia, user interaction, network access, complicated by the fact that it's a network operating system. That is, you can get data from various sources on the network, so there is a high question of security and trust. Where does the data come from? You're going to take data that is going to run on your computer, right? Program in JavaScript. So you have to have the security question really solved before you do that. So when we organize our work internally for the HTML5 platform, we call that Application Foundation. We split our work in different domains in W3C, where you know people can more easily identify what's going on in one particular area. So we have, of course, security and privacy. Security, we work a lot with IETF on that, on crypto, you know, and things that are both at the protocol and at the web API level. Privacy is also a concern for the network layer, but much more for the application level. So we've been working on privacy for years on issues like do not track. When you go to a site, you want to tell the site that they don't have to track your mouse movement or your data, your personal profile, in a sense. And the website would have to do that because there are legislation that express this in some region of the world. So we have issue with do not track, with privacy between a server and a client as well all the time. The application life cycle of a web application is very different than one of a native application. So we have to invent new tools and new technology for that. Of course, media, real-time communication is something that everybody wants, so we have to work on that. One thing that's important on the web is nowadays communication, directly communication between browser. Instead of having to go to a server, like you go to a Twitter server to communicate with another Twitter user, you could communicate directly with the user using what we call RTC, WebRTC, real-time communication with another host. The mobile web was something that we started very early on the mobile, you know, explosion. So we are now well advanced in terms of tracking the platform so that it can be programmed on the mobile as well. We have, as I mentioned, we still have to do some catch up with new devices that are new capability, that are new sensor, anything that is added to the platform. And we have, I mentioned here, a lot of horizontal activity of W3C that are a concern for everyone. So accessibility, for instance, is systematically reviewed for all the technology at W3C. Same thing for internationalization, making sure that all the technologies support the full Unicode system, plus the character model of the web, plus, you know, things that are very specific to the internationalization of the web. I'll mention that later on. You can access most of the work of W3C, the status of each working group, the implementation level in different browser, the existence of testing, of validator, online validator for all our technology in a big table that we call the roadmap, which is a public resource, so you can access that. And that would give you also a pointer to the specific group working on that so that you can join the group if you're interested. So working with W3C does not mean that you have to be a member of W3C. If you're an expert, a technical expert in one area, you can ask the status of invited expert and you'll join the group to participate as the others. So this is a slide that sort of lists all the acronyms that are heard in the W3C community, I would say. So they are completely different from the ICANN acronyms, you can see. But there are technology that you probably read about on, you know, in magazines and everything. So web services, XML, styling. Today we talked a lot about linked data, open data for government. How do government express, you know, or publish their open data is a matter of standard as well. And there are, of course, you know, very central things like the URI, the Uniform Resource Identifier or Uniform Resource Locator, which is the cornerstone of the web. An address on the web is really what makes the web so powerful. You can click on link, you can activate link, but you can also use link to identify things that are much more powerful than with just a web of documents. You can give meaning to link with the web, the semantic web. So the open web platform today is not just a web of publisher and document to present information. It's also being used in the industry, whether it's in the health industry, in the automotive industry, transport. And we have to account for that. So all these sector of the what we call verticals of the industry, they also want to add their own requirement to the HTML5 platform. So that's important, because if you want to end up, that's not concerned so much the end user, but the way your car is going to display your information on a screen, you know, on-screen location in your automobile, is going to be in HTML5, the same as you access on the web, the same as you access on your mobile. Why? Because it's just much easier for the car maker to develop it that way. They can test bed everything on the same platform in a different environment, not live in the car. So that's a good advantage for them. And in the end, you can expect that there will be much more interoperability as well for the user, be able to come up with a plugin for your car to make something different. So the web that we see today, and I'll stop here before I go into some more detailed activity, is mostly a web of API. You have to understand that the web initially was a web of format. You had the HTML format with the angle bracket, title. That's still there, of course, but that's not the way the programmer sees the web nowadays. They see that as function that they call into a library. Right, you create a title element with a function, you access the title element with another function. Everything is an API nowadays. So these API, they're just like library, and they all are specific to a particular area. So you have geolocation API, an API that would give you either the GPS location or something more abstract, like I'm in Marrakesh in this hotel, because I can both use the GPS and a map, or I can use the Wi-Fi address. You know, there is a geographical binding between a Wi-Fi and IP network and a point on the map. So the geolocation has to care for the precise location of the GPS, but as well as the usual location information that a programmer would want. So I mentioned most of the technology already. They are all being added to the web platform, basically, as we speak. So one word on the overall principle of standardization. You may have heard of something called OpenStand, which was launched a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. It was the sort of the recognition by the three major internet organizations doing standard, IETF, IEEE, and W3C, that if you can connect today on the internet from wherever you are on the planet, in Australia, in Morocco, in the US, it's because you have a few standards that have been worked on using the same principle, the principle of cooperation, of openness, transparency. You consider Wi-Fi, DSL, TCP, IP, HTML, HTTP, all these standard that you use, everybody use every day, have been guided by those principles. So we decided to put that in stone, basically, and say, okay, that's the way we work, and we would like that more standard organization work that way as well. So we created some kind of brand, you know, a logo that explained to people that that's the way standard organization make a miracle like the internet. So there are some important things here that are not used by all the standard organizations in the world. You know, voluntary adoption is something usually that government, you know, consider as a parameter. You know, you can have a regulatory standard, something that you have to follow. For instance, the electrical plug in a wall. It's forbidden to make another kind of plug. It's just forbidden. You can make it, but you're not going to be able to sell it. There is a legislation based on the standard for electrical plug. And that's okay. I mean, if you didn't have that, you'd have to test your plug. It doesn't work. So in the world of the internet, as much as it's true for the root system of ICANN as for HTML or HTTP, everything is voluntary. There is no obligation to point your bind to the root of the DNS. You can point it to another root, up to you. If you want to invent your own HTML6 format, that's fine. You can take our work and do it, and you can publish your page in HTML6. That's all it's going to do. You know, probably not a lot of people are going to be able to read your HTML6 extension unless all the browser on the planet have agreed as well to use it and to understand it. So the base of the voluntary adoption is that there is at some point, you know, the multi-stakeholder and the size of the community make it that you have to follow the stream, basically. It's very hard to depart from the standard. You can innovate, and then you can prove that your innovation is valuable for everybody. And if you're willing to share your innovation, then it goes into the standard. So that's a different sort of a process than the usual business process or the old standard process as well. Okay, so I'll go to some specific area in my second part of the talk, but I'd like to stop to answer any question you have on the overall W3C model. Before that, yeah, I forgot to mention that yesterday, the relationship between W3C and ICANN. So when ICANN was created in 98, we were one of the, what was called then the Protocol Supporting Organization, PSO, because we were, with IETF, one of the standard organization important for the web at that time already. And even though we don't, use we don't change the way the DNS or TCP/IP work, we are heavy user of this technology, of course. A web address is centered on a DNS address, and then you have additional information on top of the host. But the host is very important. That's the bottleneck for the web, basically. You know, it's the thing that we don't control, and that's the thing that there is one resource on the internet that controls it. It's ICANN and the root. But everything else that we do doesn't have a bottleneck. You know, you can create your own MIME type. You can create your own HTML format. If it works better, then you open something new, and maybe you're going to have a success in that. But it's a everything else is centered on a critical resource. So when the PSO work stopped, I think we were part of what was called the technical liaison group, which was in addition to IETF, there was ITU and ETSI, and we were in rotation. We had a seat on the board of ICANN in rotation for a while. So I was on the board of director of 2006-2007 as W3C representative. And then the most recent bylaw change did something different. So now W3C is still part of the technical liaison group and technical expert group, but we don't have a seat on the board anymore. We just are part of an advisory body of ICANN. So some question on the organization, and then I'll do some more technical presentation.
Before we open up the questions for the floor, I know we have a very patient question that's been sitting in the remote participation. So, Kathy, if you can.
I have a question from Ashwani Safner from UNDP. Question is, could we create innovative ideas pertaining to W3C and submit as projects to the committee of W3C?
Yes. We've done something that I didn't mention because it's marginal for us, but we created a new formal group at W3C called the Community Group. We did that 3 or 4 years ago. We have now more than 1,000 community groups. So this is a completely open group. It's an online tool. You can go with a couple of friends and create a community group to work on. I did one myself as an individual to create one for thinking about a format to represent a road accident, you know, on the web. So if you want to know where the road accidents are happening on the road, then you have to have some metadata information that you want to put in some format. So I created a community group for that, and then people were interested, and they can bring the ID to the W3C working group level and make it a standard in the end. So we have this system that is in place that anybody can use. It's all open to the public.
Thank you. Any questions in the room here? Yes, please.
Hello, I'm Lisa Rembo from Kenya, and I wanted to ask if you have any resources on open data standards, especially for governments.
Yes. There is an entire activity of W3C called Linked Open Data, where they are looking at format that government can use to publish their data in a way that is both public and private. You know, there are some curating of data that you want to do before making data public, because there are some private information that the government held. So we have this working group that have pages on W3C that you can go to. You know, you can just look for that, Open Data W3C or Linked Data W3C. It's usually based on the what's called the Resource Description Framework system, which is the semantic web system. So if I give you some more technical, the web originally HTML or even XML, it's a hierarchical format. So you have a format that express which element in a document is a children of which element. It's a tree, right? And on the semantic web, you express something in a different way. You're framing in a graph-oriented way. So you say, something is related to something. It's a triplet. It's always a triplet. So there is no something is the parent of an element. Is something is the parent of a list of something. So that's the first triplet. And the list of something is made of this element. That's another triplet. So it's the resource description framework on a semantic web allows for making much richer assertion on the public data that the government would publish. You know, they can say whether it's related to a particular field of the data that the data set that they have. They can give information on access. They can give information on where the data comes from. It's very important to know the origin of the data. So everything can be signed, oversigned, etc. So that's the semantic web is the basis for the open data, and you can find everything we do on the web. There are some rating as well for open data that we call the 5-star system. So when someone publishes open data on the web, whether it's a government or a corporation, you have a level of quality, basically. 1-star means that it's on the web. It may be a big image that is completely inaccessible to most of the people, but you have a scan of a document, you know, on the web. 2-star means that it's something that can be read by a machine more intelligently, right? So you may have an Excel file, but you don't give much information about the rows and the column information. But you have an Excel file with data, so a human can pre-process, post-process this information and making something useful. Then you have 3-star. You start giving semantic to your data. It can be any format. It can be Excel. It can be HTML. It can be CSV. But you give semantic. It's something that can be used in itself by reference to the semantic. Then 4-star would be you use a real semantic-oriented format. And 5-star would be not only you use real semantic web or format, but all your data sets are linked together. So if you access something, you can follow a link to something else, etc. So you have this level of quality that we publish, and government will adopt them. You know, we don't do any enforcement, so we just give ways for people to expressing their information.
Yeah, please.
Is that the same with for big data, especially for initiatives around big data for planning and development?
Well, big data is, first I would say that it's a stupid name. In a few years from now, people will laugh at us calling big data big today. But anyway, it's just a matter of algorithm to use the data. So the semantic web is a part of the big data equation, if you want. If you have data that is more rich than raw data, then you can do better algorithm. But if you don't, then you can still do some algorithm for big data. So it's an orthogonal concept. Big data means that you're doing different kind of searching and deduction than you would usually do with database, with usual database system. So it's more like you know that you have thousands of information about the pronunciation of something that means something, right? And you do statistic. You say, if I get something that sounds like that, then it probably needs, you know, 99% of the chance that it needs, it means this thing. So that's the way, you know, voice recognition works today, statistic. You just compare things to other things and you say, well, it's likely to be that. You don't try to understand things. So it's a difference on the algorithm level, not so much at the format level.
We have a question over here.
Yes. thank you very much for a very elaborative presentation and comments. I have a couple of questions. First is that do you have any part? Actually, I am Mohammed Shabir from Pakistan. Do you have any partner organizations from Pakistan particularly or South Asian regions? First. Second is that you talked about accessibility standards for persons with disabilities. I actually know about the process WCAG 2.0 of W3C, and it's really impressive and a very good work. But how do you engage persons with disabilities actually in the process? Do you partner with the organizations? Or how do you ensure their presence in the process, in the actual process? And lastly, some governments like US and UK and EU now, they are enforcing their own accessibility standards. So how do these standards, governmental standards and W3C standards, they come along in the processes?
Okay. Thank you. So all the questions about accessibility are for second part of my presentation. There is an accessibility section in my presentation. I'll answer all that next. The first question on the presence in Pakistan and this region, we have an office in India, in Delhi, that you can go to get information, more information about WC activity in general. And in terms of participation, it's hard to say like that because we have probably more than 5,000 people working daily within our working group. So it's hard for me to tell which one are coming from Pakistan or which member we have from this region. But in terms of the staff presence, we don't have staff in Pakistan that I know of. We have staff in India. So that's the first answer. So for accessibility, if there are no other questions, I'll move on to that part of my presentation.
Any other questions in the room? All right, let's get technical.
Okay. So, yeah. So Web Accessibility Initiative, it's one of the domain of W3C. So we have four or five domains at W3C. One concerned with data, open data, I mentioned the semantic web, another one with more the HTML language itself. We have an a domain concerned with the mobile and everything that is, universal access to the web, whether it's from a car or from a radio. And we have a technology and society domain as well, which is concerned with security, privacy, content selection, things like that. And this domain, Web Accessibility Initiative, was created very early on in 97 at W3C. And the purpose was to make sure that the technology that W3C deliver, all the standards, you know, whether it's HTML, XML, etc., would be accessible. So we had to define first what it meant and then to look at most of the problem that we're trying to solve. It's not just for visual disability, it's also for mobility, for hard of hearing, for cognitive disability. So the scope of the disability is any disability. And the problem we're trying to solve is to reformat the data that the user send, or being able to reformat it for the user preference. So the idea was that when you have content that is accessible, then it can be accessed by mostly the person preference media. So if you want to, if you only have text input, for instance, and text output, then the page in HTML could be serialized so that you could present that to the user. So, of course, there are problems not just with the multimedia part of the content, but also with the navigation, with the structural part of the information, and also with the overall, appearance of the site, whether or not when you're changing page within a site, you get lost or not. So there is always a fine line between usability and accessibility, but the concern of the web accessibility is for the disability part. So the idea with accessibility is that it's okay to degrade the content, original content, but it's never okay to degrade the function. So if you have a website or a page on a website whose function is to have you select a town in Morocco where you want to go, for instance, then the natural user interface that people would provide is a map of Morocco and ask the user to click on the town where they want to go. You show the town, you click on the town, and that's where your distance is going to appear or you're going to rent something, right? So the function goes through a graphical interface in this case, but it's easy to imagine that you can provide a list of town, right? Just a textual list, a menu, and you know that this menu can be serialized easily. You know, people can navigate menu one by one, or they can go alphabetical order, they can reverse the, you can imagine interface that works on just a list of town that can be very valuable for the end user. So the function is what's important. And the function of a website usually is to have you navigate through the website to go to do something. So this is a very important function in the guideline that we produce, the part of the navigation, the part on the media, etc. So this work on accessibility is mostly divided in three parts. There is the accessibility of the content, so what's called the Web Content Accessibility Guideline, which is really the mother of all guidelines for the web accessibility. It's what people are using when they adapt accessibility to their context. Usually they start from this guideline. But what we've tried to do over the years is to make sure that there is only one guideline. So we transpose this guideline into an ISO standard. And the reason for that is that it gives the content of the work, the technical standard, much more stability. If you consider a government that have to pass legislation that would, you know, guide them during procurement to procure accessible technology, they would want to have a national standard based on the WCAG, and sometimes they would change the WCAG content because it's a standard that's human readable in a sense. It's not like the HTML or the XML standard. The WCAG standard is written in English, or it's been translated in many languages, but it's written in human language and explain what to do to a designer, to a programmer. It's not an instruction for a program. So given that, you know, a lot of people have changed the guideline, not realizing that by doing that, they create fragmentation and the industry cannot provide a tool that is accessible along different standards in every part of the planet. Right, IBM or Microsoft, they want to sell a browser to an organization that is a government agency. They want to sell the same in France as in Germany or in Pakistan because it's going to be a nightmare for them. It's already hard to have to globalize all the standards. I'll go back to that, you know, to make sure that the language and the date and all the cultural things are specific to the country. If you have to change the technical implementation, it's a nightmare. So the industry was in favor of stabilizing this standard. The government were in favor, so it became an ISO standard. Web services also became an ISO standard along that same line. So now we have those three guidelines. One of them is an ISO standard. The other guidelines concern each side of the production and the reading of this accessible content. So it's not enough to say this is how accessible content should look like. You have to explain how to produce accessible content using what we call an authoring tool, an editor of HTML like Dreamweaver or anything, or even a content management system that lets you create page with graphics, they should follow guideline of their own that would explain, for instance, in a CMS, in a content management system, that you're going to add a logo to a page, then it would extract automatically the textual representation of this logo. If it's a logo for W3C, which is hard to represent using real letter because it has, you know, it has graphics everywhere, then you can say this is W3C. The function of this logo is to say W3C. So you say that in the markup, and the tool that you use to create this page would automatically get the description of the image that you use because someone has probably already described it. So there are guidelines for the authoring side and, of course, guidelines for the browser side, for the user agent side. When you read an HTML page, you have to understand how to decode a particular element, a particular attribute, to change it into a different modality. So there are both guidelines that are as important as well. So now the way this work was done in the past is that we have different working groups, about 7 or 8 working groups. There are some that are dedicated to explaining to people what to do because it's not just about technology, it's about education and outreach, explaining to people the obligation that they have sometimes to make accessible website. And we also have a research working group which is specific to this activity because there are always progress on the, I would say, the programming side. You know, it used to be that it was very hard for machine to understand human audio, but nowadays there are progress on that. So at some point we would say that the subtitle had to be provided obligatory, you know, for making the data understood by hard of hearing deaf people. But nowadays you can imagine that a video stream that doesn't have subtitle that is coming to your browser could be attached to some kind of series algorithm or, you know, voice recognition algorithm that would extract the subtitle and insert the subtitle for you. So there are progress in the technology in various aspects of the field. You know, in sign language, there are progress as well. You can soon you're going to be able to produce sign language on the screen based on markup language. So we have to follow that as well. So to answer the question that was asked about accessibility, the first question is there is a lot of work by government to adopt in their legislation some variant of the web content accessibility guideline. Hopefully, I would say that nowadays most of the people are referencing the real guideline, the W3C guideline, or the ISO guideline, which is exactly the same. It just has a different name. And that fact is it's something that people now, changing the guideline itself, something that people think twice before doing. Even though they still have the right to change that, the ISO copyright is such that the national member of ISO, like AFNOR, or the country member of ISO, can still make modification and adapt a standard when they transpose it to their country in their language. But for the web and for internet technology, they usually never do that. So we have this table thing. Now, since it took about 5 or 6 years to go from the WCAG at W3C to the ISO, in the meantime, the European Commission had also mandated some work on accessibility standard, and ETSI has produced a standard, EN something, right, which also includes the W3C guideline. Include inside their standard, they have the W3C guideline copy, cut and paste. So that's not good, in terms of standard, but you have to imagine that it's a transition. But soon, when this EN makes it to make a higher level of standard, they're going to change this copy into a reference, most probably, because that makes sense, So I wouldn't worry too much about fragmentation in the future. It's something of the past. We've been fighting with fragmentation for a while, but I think we're fine now. So in terms of participation, so the way working groups are populated with users with disability, they give us their input. I mean, they come and they say, we have used this tool, and this tool doesn't follow this guideline because either the guideline is wrong or the tool is wrong. So we have a, a very big community, a large interest group where the public can participate, don't have to be a member. All the working groups of the way are public, in fact, except for one, but I think it became public, which was concerned with the technology of W3C evolution. So, you know, a lot of participation, a lot of testing. We don't run an accessibility bureau in a sense. You know, there is an industry behind on top of this guideline nowadays. People that are making a business of checking page and repairing page for accessibility, and they have labor that they create for the kind of evaluation that they've done. So there is really an ecosystem on top of this technology. Okay. So another what we call horizontal activity at W3C is internationalization. So you've heard of the internationalized domain name and the problem of the internet itself, which was created without thinking too much about non-English use of the internet. But nowadays, hopefully, we have resolved most of the problem. And that is because of one technology, it's called Unicode. So Unicode is not done by ITF, it's not done by W3C, it's done by the Unicode Consortium. And it's a technology that basically provides a level playing field for all the other technology that express textual things. So it's everybody, basically. And before Unicode, if you're young, you don't remember, but before Unicode, if you were a programmer and you wanted to encode your character in some other language than your own, then you had to spend a lot of time trying to understand which encoding this language was used for. You know, government usually in Japan, they had 3 or 4 encoding for a different representation of Japanese. Same thing in most countries. So Unicode say, okay, no, one character, one code, and we have enough characters for the entire planet. So now we operate under any code, but for the web, it's not enough. I mean, you have to provide a character model. You have to provide a lot of cultural things that are dependent, not just on the language, but on the culture. So we produce standards specific to internationalization, and we explain a lot in terms of how to represent a page so that it can be translated into another language. It's not just a matter of translating the word. You have to translate a lot of the presentation material. So if you look at, for instance, the date, the problem with date, you know, it's easy to say that an input field in a page is a date, and that's about the only thing that a programmer should have to worry about. As a programmer, I want to make an application. I envision that my application is going to be used in all culture on the planet. My market is the planet to start with. I'm not thinking French or US. So I want to say, okay, at some point I'm going to need a date in my application. Input type date, that's it. It's the most easier for the HTML programmer. But then under the cover, you have to think about what it means. You know, it means a lot of things depending on the culture. You have to look at the locale. You have to look at the guidelines for the language, depending if you use a graphical or a more like a visual 2D presentation to select the date. So all of that has to be explained to people before they do browser, before they do web page. Another area that's important for W3C is privacy and security, of course. We do a lot of the security work with IETF, which is our, I would say, our favorite partner, SDO. Because W3C was started as an IETF application area, we share a lot of either practice or technology expertise with IETF. So to mention HTTP, HTTPS, URI, all the web addresses system is done within IETF with heavy participation from W3C, and nowadays we've been creating real-time communication, mirror group in IETF and W3C. So you have RTC Web at IETF, which is looking at real-time communication between two hosts, and W3C is doing Web RTC, which is providing, you know, HTML extension for doing that from the browser. So we have a lot of work together. Now, for privacy, we do a lot of work on the fact that when you connect to a server with your web credential and your identity, you're going to give away some of this data. So it's important that between negotiation between the server and the client, beyond all the negotiation that's happening under the hood, that you don't see about format, about language, about your preference, we should have preference for privacy. Things like, I don't want to be tracked. Things like, you can use my first name, but you cannot use my address. Things like that. So you can express that with some of the standard that we produce here. Let's see. If you want to know more about privacy and security and activity, our domain leader, Wendy Selzer, is in this meeting this week. So you can talk to her. You'll see Wendy on her badge. And you can talk about how to participate in those, what is happening nowadays. I'd like to say a word on the sort of the policy matters at W3C. So we're a technical consortium. We've never been really involved in politics. We always try to get away from that. But nevertheless, we've always been talking with government and legislation, if only to explain to them what the technology can help, you know, for their problem. So the first example of that is PIX. You know, when I joined W3C in 95-96, it was the hot button then, because the U.S. Congress or U.S. whatever, they wanted to pass a legislation that would just say everything that is indecent should be forbidden on the Internet. The word used in the legislation was indecent. So indecent doesn't mean anything on the Internet to start with. I'm not sure it means something within the United States, but we had to explain to the legislator that instead of doing this kind of subjective definition for a technology, they should use objective criteria. So we thought about using, it was sort of the ancestor of the semantic web. We told them that we could create a format which was called PIX. It's a small textual format that lets you describe various level of content. So there are four levels. There were four levels because it hasn't been kept this way. But there's a nudity level. So nudity level, you can express yourself objectively. You can say frontal nudity, backward nudity. You can say that you see more or less. That's very objective, right? You can be anatomical in a sense. And you have violence level. So you have a widely agreed, you know, position for violence, whether there is blood, whether there is not blood. So you have levels that are objective as well. You have gambling as well, which is one area, etc. So with this objective level that you can attach as metadata to a page, then the question of legislation is moot, because you can decide on your end whether at the level of a country, if you want, but at the level of an organization or a family, to block various content based on the objective criteria and your own rating. You can say, you know, my kids in France, they are fine with frontal nudity because everybody is frontal nudity on the beach in France, right? But in the U.S., you would say, no, the kid in school, they should not see frontal nudity because it's not the way we work. So you can adapt for a culture, you know, this kind of objective criteria. And that's the semantic web, in effect. The semantic web lets you do that. You can describe things in objective or, you know, recognized vocabulary, which is called ontology. And if this ontology is widely accepted, then you can make, you know, either filtering for good, or you can do also censorship. You know, you have to realize that any technology that gives you more power, like a hammer, can be used to do the right thing or the wrong thing. So the semantic web is a hammer. It lets you do very good thing, much more intelligent searching and filtering for the good, but it can also let you operate censorship bureau, because everything is described. So if something is, you know, labeled political, opposed to whatever country, and I'm in this country, it's just a check mark. Yeah. So you have to account for that. But anyway, that's the way the technology has always worked. There's a good side and a bad side. The technology itself is neutral. So that was the first installment of our legislative sort of discussion. Then the web accessibility I mentioned, that's been all the time. That's been the case that government, they have to make website accessible because people with disability, they pay tax and the tax are used to run those websites, or they pay tax through the website, which is even more important for the government. If you cannot pay your tax and you can say, well, your site is giving all the instruction by voice and I'm deaf, you know, sorry, I cannot pay the tax. So the government were pushing for having accessibility as a recognized standard so that it can enforce it to your technologies, to their technology. So that has a lot of implication as well. And it was a good dialogue because we were both on the same boat. You know, we wanted more accessibility. And even though they wanted that, the government, they want that to protect themselves. You know, they want to make sure that they did the right thing. They also want it for ethical reason, of course, but also they realize that anything that is accessible on the web is easier to use for most people. And that's the case for most of the accessibility feature, in fact. You know, if you look at the curb cut on the sidewalk in the street, you know, the real accessibility for wheelchair, well, if you look and you count, you know, find that 9% out of 10 is not on a wheelchair. They just carry a luggage with wheel, or they push a baby on wheel. So, you know, accessibility is good for everyone. Usually it's simple design that gives you the most functional power. So since then, you know, since the 2000, I would say that internet governance has taken up the role of driving us into discussion with government. So open standard was a long discussion as well between patent, not patent, whether or not it was done by a company and forced into a standard. So the issue of open standard, license, open source, all that, it's still going on, but it's been a bit quieter nowadays. But a few years ago, it was very heavy discussion. And I think we now have this system where most of the technology are free for the web and the internet, and we just want to make sure that it will stay that way. So we're trying to write the rules after the fact nowadays. Privacy, security, sector, public information was also a lot of debate. For instance, we participate in European Commission project and debate to decide whether or not public sector information should be free or not. You know, that's a typical question that a government agency would ask is, I'm okay to give all this information, like the map, the geographical information, all the things that are public and that people have paid for already. You know, the government, they are paid by the citizen. So it's not good to have the citizen pay again to access the data. But there is an overhead, usually. It's not as simple as turning a machine on and saying, now it's public, and before it was not public. Usually those documents, they are on computer, but they are on computer that are not connected. You have to curate the data. There is a cost for a government to publish open data. There is no doubt about that. So the debate was how to reimburse this cost. You can have a system by which the public data is only going to professional of the market that pay a subscription, and these professionals, they give it away to the citizen using their own business model, which can be free or not. And the prevailing model nowadays is that to say that if the more government data is given for free, the bigger the market is going to be. And the bigger market is going to be, the more taxes the government is going to get through VAT or through increase of business. So if you can sell more things based on public data, then you create a market, money is circulating, government is making a tax on that. So they realize that, and now most of the model is that to make it free and to have it actually used by as many people as possible to innovate on top of that. But that was another policy-making discussion you can think about. Nowadays, we have passed this step where, you know, the work that we do at W3C or IETF for that matter, or IEEE, it's not officially recognized by government. They recognize ISO, they recognize the national body, the regional body. But in fact, you know, they have to use our technology. There is no other choice. If you order a technology for the internet, you're going to use IETF and W3C standards. So there is a trend now to recognize our work, you know, officially. So there are changes in legislation in Europe that passed a few years ago that just list W3C and IETF as valid consortia that produce standards that are equivalent to the de jure standard system, right? We still have to go through processes to validate our spec one by one. It's not like we had a blank check for everything that W3C does. So there is a system called the multi-stakeholder platform in Europe that lets us do that to present technology. But I would say that it's working. You know, people are not blocked because of this kind of matters. And of course, the new technology that you see at the last line here, Web of Thing, web payment, these are things that we started last year. You know, web payment, for instance, I joined W3C in 96 to work on what's called the joint payment initiative. It lasted a couple of years and then it failed. It failed because the Visa and the MasterCard, they decided to lower their fee dramatically on the web. So the only reason for doing payment, a specific payment system on the web at that time, 20 years ago, was micropayment. But micropayment also didn't get an agreement in industry, so we basically stopped payment for years. And last year we reopened the issue of web payment because people, again, the programmer wanting to write a web page, if I want to write a web page, the same way that I said, input is a date on my web page and I don't care about the way the date is implemented for the culture. I want to say at this point, ask the person to pay this amount. That's all I need to. I'm a programmer in HTML. I don't want to have to deal with bank. I want to just say at this point in my page, here is the price that people have to pay. I do the calculation, of course. This is my website, but I don't want to have to deal with all the detail of the payment. And of course, this is a highly, you know, political agenda because payment is governed today. Electronic payment is governed by thousands of standards, you know, in the financial sector. We have to integrate with that. So this is a very important group. Here I mentioned deep linking at the end. What time is it there?
Yeah,
15 minutes. Okay. Oh, we'll have some time for questions. So deep linking, just to mention one policy aspect that is still, bothering us in a sense. So years ago, we had a statement from our TAG, from our technical architectural group, saying that people that wants to prevent, you know, other people to link directly below their portal site or their homepage, you know, they have to do that through access control. They cannot operate by what's called hidden by obscurity. They cannot assume that because someone went through their portal to go through an article on their page, right, without entering any password, I'm talking about access, open access, then that this URI, the URI of the article itself, is a different URL for the system. So we have to explain that the web has no concept of homepage. There's no such thing as a portal URI, specific portal URI or a homepage. So all the links, whether it's a deep link in your website or the homepage of your company, they are the same link for the web. The tools, the browser, they consider they are the same link. There is no notion of that. So it's very hard then for someone to understand how to prevent someone to link to a remote part of their site. Usually they don't want that. Some provider, they want people to go to their home and follow a track that they decide. But unfortunately on the web, people use hyperlink. Hyperlink means that you can link to anything. So that's an issue that we have to keep explaining to legislator that, you know, it's impossible to for the platform to make the difference between those two links. So there's no question of having a law, a legislation on that. We cannot implement it. So that's the kind of discussion we have. Okay, so I'm about done, so I'll let, you know, some question now. You have everything on this page in terms of summary. So the summary is that we're a growing community, that we have a more and more societal issue we deal with. So if you think that you are not technical enough in the past, I think it's time that you look at the web problems today. As I mentioned, W3C is one champion of the open standard because of our royalty-free policy that has been adopted by our industry. People take for granted the fact that the web is there. It's been there for 25 years. It's free and people use it everywhere. But we still ourselves, I mean, we see the thing differently. We see that there is a competition. Whenever you go to a mobile application today or mobile website, they still ask you whether or not you want to download their native application for your system or whether you want to go to the website. And if you go to the website, the user experience is usually not the same. It's a little bit less sort of fluent and everything. So that's a technology problem today that we hope is going to be fixed in the future. And the advantage for the provider of information is that they only have to maintain one website that is accessible through the car, through the mobile, through the desktop, through a big screen, small screen, etc. So I think we have the odds on our side. You know, the extension of the native platform is going at some point to converge with the added feature that we put in HTML. You know, once you can have a device of that size that does everything, you know, smell for you, give you direction, give you the altitude and everything, all the API that you have on this device today to let you program the device, we'll put them on the web so that you can have them on the web as well, and it will make no difference except for the fact that, you know, it will be a better support for the entire universe of the web. And the other thing is that the web application, today they don't work offline, but we've been working with technology that would make it as well to work offline, you know, just like as a native application. Okay.
Okay. Any questions in the room? Okay, we do have one question in the chat room, and then I'll come back to the room.
Question is from Ashwini Sathner again from UNDP. Would the modules of payments be interlinked to the privacy and security modules within the W3C?
I missed a word. With the module, the first? I missed one word.
Would the modules of payments be interlinked to the privacy and security modules?
Sure, of course. So the W3C works with a working group that are themselves, I would say, organized in activity and in domain, and there are coordination group. So, of course, the web payment activity and working group is very much linked to the privacy and security group, but not just that, you know, also to the internationalization group, to the accessibility group, to make sure that all these technology are you know, coordinated to give the same level of experience to the user. So, yeah, there's no doubt about that, yeah.
Great, thank you. I believe also that we are joined by our next gen group, which are students from local universities. So all from Rabat, I believe. I'd like to specifically ask if any of you have any questions. And Daniel, I'm going to put you on the spot. If you want to ask the question in French, please do. Mm-hmm. All I ask is that we're streaming in English, so if you would be willing to
translate,
translate or summarize the question and answer. Are there any questions at all from the students? None?
No.
Okay. You had that opportunity. With that, I'd like to thank Daniel, please, for this wonderful presentation on understanding the W3C. Thank you. We have passed out a short survey to better understand how we're doing as for this program. We ask that you please just take a moment and fill out just a few questions on how the session went and how we could be doing better. We listen to this. We try to make these sessions interesting for and relevant for the community that comes to watch these. So please take a moment to do that. Oh, is there a question? Oh, all right.
Thank you very much. Je vais parler en français. Voilà. Normalement, pour l'élaboration de la charte commune de l'interopérabilité de la charte des portails institutionnels, on a utilisé le codage en W3C. Mais est-ce que vous avez pour la langue amazigh une spécification à ce niveau-là? Et merci.
So the question is related to internationalization and whether or not the Amazigh language, which is the Berber original Berber language spoken in the mountain, which has its own alphabet. You know, it's, it predates the Arabic alphabet in the region. Whether or not it's supported in the web, is that the question? Or there is a specific work on that? I don't know. Is it in Unicode? I mean, that would be my first question. If there is work for this particular language and encoding in Unicode, then it's also on the web, because we have a correspondence and we explain how to use the various alphabet. So I can point you at our leader for internationalization, which would give you the update on both the Unicode and the website. It's called Richard Shida. You can find him. He's in England and he's a worldwide expert in Unicode and web. So, but at least I know the language. I've seen it, and I don't know. I mean, you probably know more than I.
Thank you for that. We're going to be breaking for lunch. The lunch hour is lunch hours is from 12 to 1:30. We'll be back here in this room at 1:30 this afternoon, and we will have Alain Durand from ICANN. He's one of our chief research engineers, and he'll be going over internet networking. And it's quite interesting. So I ask and encourage you all to please come back and join us after lunch. So thank you very much.